here with this week's hottest stories in the investment world. This is Zach's Friday Finish Line.
Hello, and welcome to a special edition of the Zach's Friday Finish Line. I'm Ryan McQueenie, a content writer here at Zach's, joined by one of our editors, Maddie Johnson.
Hello, and you are right. This is a special episode of The Finish Line, as we will be joined by an expert guest to fill us in on everything there is to know about the Chinese economy and investing in China.
Yes, we will be joined by Brendan Ahern, the Chief Investment Officer at Crane Shares. Crane Shares is a leading provider of China-focused exchange-traded funds and Chinese investment education. The company currently operates 5 different ETFs and hosts a wide range of China-related research and information. All right, thanks for joining us, Brendan. First, can you touch on some of your own personal background in China, investing, ETFs, and what led you to get involved at Crane Shares?
Yeah, definitely, Ryan. I had joined Barclays Global Investors in early 2001 during the rollout of the iShares family of exchange-traded funds. When I joined iShares in the early 2000s, the ETF industry was still pretty small, and for iShares ourselves, we had really de minimis or little to no assets. And over the course of the next 13 years with iShares, I was part of helping to grow the business up to over $800 billion globally. And so I just had this incredible experience of being part of the growth of the ETF industry at the largest provider of ETFs globally. And had the chance to meet our founder, John Crane, who's an American who had lived in China and done business in China, and when he came back from China, was surprised that the traditional definition of China was for investors, was really just Chinese companies in Hong Kong, as well as there was not little to no activity or exposure to the onshore equity, the Shanghai and Shenzhen stock exchanges, as well as China's bond market. And was really looking to get into the ETF business, and we were able to connect and left iShares about 4 years ago to join Crane Shares and help really build the firm from the ground up. And we've had our first funds up about 3.5 years now. So it's really the whole world I know is the exchange-traded funds and indexing business, and then I've really worked to apply that knowledge to our product set today.
Yeah, so let's start by taking a look at the Chinese economy. So, of course, from our American perspective, we know that U.S. companies do a lot of business with Chinese manufacturers, but let's try to paint a bigger picture. What kinds of things are currently driving the Chinese economy? Where does it rank on the global scale? And what types of areas will drive future growth?
Yeah, that's a great question, Maddie. China obviously is the second largest economy in the world, and in many ways, it's almost like the middleman in global trade, where it sells developed products, manufactured products, to the developed world. At the same time, it's importing commodities and inputs in order to build those goods. So there's a lot you can learn about the global economy from studying China. What's changed in China over the last really decade has been the rise of domestic consumption, that China's service sector now accounts for actually 50% of GDP. So just as the U.S. has moved away from being manufacturing to more of a service economy, China's going through that same transition itself, and it's actually much further along than I believe most investors are aware, that literally 50% of China's GDP today is driven by domestic consumption.
Interesting. I think starting to touch on something that I saw that Crane Shares had put out related to a 3 common misconceptions that people have about China or the Chinese economy. Can you touch more on those misconceptions and explain where they might come from?
Well, after 4 years of being part of Crane Shares, we found that there was a lot of the concerns or misperceptions around China were common amongst investors, both individual investors or even professional investors or even institutional investors. And we wrote this piece just to really come out and address these issues around one, ghost cities, the lack of understanding of how China's domestic consumption has risen, and they've diminished the dependency on exports, and lastly around the currency. And so those are the three main issues we hear, and we really wanted to really quell or provide a balanced perspective around those three issues, because we think it's a lot of the media attention to China, it's almost clickbait, sensationalistic at times, but not necessarily factually driven. And if you're going to point out the liabilities, which means you're treating China as a balance sheet, shouldn't you focus on the assets as well? So we really want to address those three issues, and I'm happy to delve into those three in particular as well, further if you like.
Yeah, I would say this idea that the Chinese economy has shifted its focus to being more domestic focused, service industry based, interesting to hear, and we've touched on that now. But you touched on also the idea of currency, and I think from our perspective, that means currency manipulation is what we always hear about. And then this idea of ghost cities too, which I think is definitely something that is talked about, but I don't know if everyone is an expert on this idea or this maybe myth of the Chinese ghost cities, if you could elaborate more on that.
Probably the single greatest accomplishment of China over the last 30 years has been the raising of over 300 million people out of poverty. And what's driven that was back in 1980, 80% of China's population lived in rural, farming, agrarian-based areas, and only 20% lived in cities. And if you fast forward to today, actually just over half of China's economy or China's population lives in cities. And why that's taken place is, goes back to the rural areas are very farming-based, very, very high levels of poverty. And when people move into a city, you're getting access to many of the things we take for granted. Proper housing, electricity, running water, as well as you're getting access to health care and education. And so as people go through that process and they get educated and go to college, they move into really white-collar service types of jobs. And so if you fast forward to today, a urban dweller in China makes as well as spends four times as much as their urban counterparts. And that's what's driven this remarkable transition of literally hundreds of millions of people being moved out of poverty. And that's been driven by moving into cities. And China has a goal. They have a stated goal to reach a 75% urbanization rate in the next several decades, which means several hundred million more rural farmers today will migrate into cities in the decades to come.
That is kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, that's it's almost jarring fact,
yeah.
Actually.
So kind of switching gears to currency manipulation, because I feel like it is one of the first things people mention about the Chinese economy these days. And as you mentioned, we seem to be a little bit ignorant about it. So is currency manipulation something that happens on a global level? And just what involvement, or if any at all, does the Chinese government have in determining the value of its currency right now?
So China is interesting in that going back 10 years ago, they did peg the renminbi to the dollar. As well as they've only allowed certain types of investors to invest capital in China. So you literally need to be approved to invest in China today. And that was based on, in the late 1990s, you had the Asian crisis where currencies collapsed and as foreign investors piled into countries like Malaysia and Indonesia, and then suddenly left. It left their economy in tatters. And China observed this and said, we're just not going to let capital come piling into our country and then have it leave at really the worst moment, because it would really leave the economy in tatters, as they witnessed from several of their neighbors. So they've slowly moved to allowing more investors in as well as out, as well as allowing the currency to really act on its own. And so, you know, today they're not explicitly benchmarked or pegged to the U.S. dollar. They compared their currency to the value of a basket of securities, and they are moving to free float. Now a lot of when people say, "Oh, China's manipulated its currency," they devalued it. Well, that's just factually inaccurate. Over the course of the last decade, the renminbi has actually appreciated pretty dramatically versus the dollar. Over the last year and a half, as U.S. Fed policy has moved toward a tightening bias, the renminbi has depreciated versus the dollar. It went from around 620 about 2 years ago into the 680, 690 range. And so, yes, it's depreciated, but that depreciation is less than what the euro, yen, or pound has depreciated versus the dollar, and compared to emerging market currencies like the Indian rupee or the Brazilian real, they've lost, in the case of Brazil, 50% of their value versus the dollar, or the rupee, it's lost over 20% versus the dollar over the last several years. So the movement of the renminbi, the depreciation, I don't think that the facts really hold in that regard.
I think it's really important before we can even really, as investors over here in America, get super interested in investing in China. It's incredibly, incredibly important to quash those misconceptions and to educate ourselves about the economy and the currency. And so we appreciate this teaching moment. But let's shift our focus now to investing in China. I think most of us over here are aware that trading stocks works just a little bit differently in China, but can you highlight some of the biggest differences in the markets over there for someone with just no experience in the country?
Yeah, I think we have to define what is China, Ryan. That the historical definition of China has been 150 Chinese companies listed in Hong Kong. So if you looked at the MSCI China, that's been their definition. So for passive investors, if you invest in broad-based emerging markets or a index fund based on China, that's been your definition. Now that definition, up until very recently, left out U.S.-listed companies, that a number of Chinese companies have listed here in the United States in order to tap our capital markets. So the definition of China has slowly evolved from 150 Chinese companies in Hong Kong to including 12 U.S.-listed Chinese companies, but it's actually excluded the Shanghai and Shenzhen stock exchanges. Those are the third and fifth largest stock exchanges in the world, and they're not included in indices like an MSCI Emerging Markets, because I mentioned that in our conversation that they've only allowed limited types of investors into China. And MSCI has excluded those two stock exchanges because of the limited access. Now that has changed very dramatically over the last really 2 years, where they're providing more and more exposure, and later on this year, MSCI is going to decide whether or not they're going to include the Shanghai and Shenzhen listed companies in their indices. And China today is approximately 25% of MSCI emerging markets. If they were to fully include the Shanghai and Shenzhen stocks, it would almost double the size of China and MSCI emerging markets. So a big value add for Crane Shares as an entity is one, to provide a balanced perspective on China, but also to let investors know that there's going to be a lot more China coming into benchmarks because of this inclusion. It's something we write a lot about because it's something that doesn't get a lot of publicity, but it's going to have a very dramatic effect on equity investors, whether active or passive, because of the size of this onshore market.
So for American investors, big Chinese stocks like Alibaba, Baidu, that's how you say it, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. JD.com and other huge big name companies are usually what I think come to mind
the
when you think
points,
of
at least, yeah.
Chinese stocks. Are there also major points of interest for Chinese investors that go beyond these other, like go beyond these like four main companies do they influence the direction of the market similarly to how the U.S. giants do?
What's really interesting, Maddie, is, and this is where, you know, I've spent the last really 16 years in the indexing space, and that's almost like a cry for help, you know, where I've really, I study these indices and how they're put together, because, you know, MSCI alone, there's $10 trillion of both active and passive assets follow their indices. And so, you know, you can imagine when they make changes, there's a lot of money that can change based on those index changes. And so, you know, what's interesting is the U.S. listed companies, like the ones you mentioned, they, up until last year, really weren't included in MSCI indices. MSCI's main competitor from an indexing perspective is a company called FTSE. FTSE indices do not include those companies today. So you contrast the U.S. listed companies. So, you know, as we talked about, Alibaba, Baidu, JD, those are companies really geared to this consumer consumption trend in China today. If you go and look at, well, what about those 150 companies in Hong Kong that are also part of the definition of China? It's all banks, energy, industrials, basic mm-hmm. materials. That's all kind of the old China sectors. So you do have a big disparity between the composition of Chinese stocks and their weight, their sector weight in these indices. And that's where, for ourselves as kind of students of China and students of indexing, you know, we've tried to create unique product that really creates a differentiator between these new and old China sectors, and the disparity in returns can be quite large.
Yeah, it goes back to that question you asked just a little bit ago, what is China? Yeah. Like, what, you know?
It's interesting that you gave us such a range of different definitions an investor could use to talk about China, because I think, you know, and as I think that our conversation has centered around, is that there's a slight ignorance over on this side of the Pacific about just how to consider the country. So I want to touch on, and I think this is a perfect segue too, when you're discussing this new and old China as far as the markets go, because I think one of the things we can very visibly witness is the growth of the Chinese middle class, and I'm sure that's from a variety of different reasons, including the kind of economic shift that you've already touched on. But there are about an estimated 225 million households in the middle class category in China right now. So big shift in demographics over the past 15, 16 years. Has China's rising middle class affected how investors in China operate or what they're focused on?
Most definitely. Yeah, I think it goes back, Ryan, you know, it's really this urban middle class. And that urban middle class is, they've gotten a taste for, you know, the Western standard of living. And I think for all investors, you know, if you look at company U.S. multinationals like Starbucks, you know, Starbucks
always comes down to Starbucks.
Yeah. Well, you know, with my hours, I mean, I spend a lot of time late at night talking to colleagues and partners in China. But you know, Starbucks is a U.S. multinational geared to the consumer, and so I think for a lot of investors, when we talk about this growth in new China sectors and the rise in domestic consumption in China, it certainly affects Chinese companies, like some of the ones, you know, we spoke about, you know, that are listed here in the United States. But it's true for Chinese companies in China as well as U.S. multinationals. And you can almost contrast that with, you know, U.S. multinationals geared to those traditional drivers of China sectors. And so this reorientation, this rise of domestic consumption, the rise of this urban middle class is creating differentiated winners, both for Chinese companies as well as U.S. And global multinationals, for that matter. And that's where it's kind of funny. You know, people will say, you know, investing in China, like that hasn't done well. And my retort is always, clearly your definition of China or where you've allocated capital, maybe that's toward the part of China that is slowing or isn't as doing as well as the parts of China's economy, as well as the capital markets that are potentially doing better.
Yeah. So just to wrap up, so obviously Crane Shares offers a variety of options that can help us get involved in Chinese stocks. Can you touch on some of your ETFs and how they might help an investor who is interested in investing in China?
So one of the funds that I think, you know, that really the groundwork of hopefully the foundation we helped to provide investors today is this idea that investing in China, just even defining China, can be a little bit difficult. So we've actually worked with Zacks Index Services to create a product. It's called the Crane Shares Zacks New China Exchange Traded Fund. The ticker is KFYP. And certainly for any investment, investors should look at the prospectus as well as the risk disclosures that are provided in the prospectus. To make sure it's suitable for one's risk reward characteristics of your own portfolio. But the reason I really like this fund myself is because it actually invests in stocks listed in China from those new China sectors, so like technology, consumer consumption, healthcare, and clean energy, as well as we're looking at stocks on the Shanghai, Hong Kong, New York, and NASDAQ exchanges, so we're able to capture the companies within those sectors, no matter, regardless of where they invest, where they happen to list. And then we're applying some smart beta or some screens around free cash flow as well as relative strength, so both a fundamental and technical screens. And so we hope that this product provides really a smarter way to invest in Chinese companies that are geared to this new China, and hopefully this product, you know, really helps provide a solution to help solve that fundamental question of, you know, what is China, or, you know, what is that definition of China?
All right, thank you so much again for joining us. As I think we've mentioned already, super informative and incredibly important when you look at just how big of a player China is in the global economy right now. So
it's bigger every day.
Yep. And you know, as American investors, becoming more and more essential to have an educated understanding of what's happening in the country right now. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Brendan.
Yeah. Have a good one.
No, my pleasure. And thank you.
Well, there you have it. Everything you need to know about investing in China right now. We want to thank Brendan for joining us this week, and I encourage you to check out Crane Shares if anything he said interested you.
And remember to shoot us an email at podcast@zacks.com if there's anything we missed or any other stories you want us to cover. Make sure to check out all of our other audio content at zacks.com/podcast. And finally, please subscribe and give us a rating. LOL, 5 stars.
As always, thank you for joining us on the Friday Finish Line, and we will see you next time.